And next week, we will have class. There'll be two guest lecturers from Robert Rausendorf talking about cluster states and their connections to stabilizer codes, or graph states anyway, and Raymond Laflamme talking about experimental quantum error correction. It's been done in some systems. Not sure which order they're going to be in, each half the time, so an hour and a half. So you won't have a new problem set, obviously, for that class, since this one is not due for 2 weeks. Okay, so then before we continue, are there any questions on the first half? And since I forgot to ask also about questions on the last lecture, you're free to ask those now, too.
Yeah. Example, is there like an easily stable example of something that's not in
there? Sure. There's a lot of examples. So if you look, so I said R pi over 4, phase rotation by this particular angle is in the Clifford group. But if you choose almost any other angle, it's not in the Clifford group. So the obvious case for this is R pi over 2, which is the z. So that's clearly it, and R minus pi over 4, or 3 pi over 4, or something like that. But all the other angles, like R pi over 8, R pi over 273, not in the Clifford group. There's plenty of other examples. Yeah?
So on last class, very simple question. When you say that two binary strings are orthogonal, so you mean orthogonal
right.
Interval 2?
So usually, when I'm talking about binary strings, I'm talking about these 2n length binary strings.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about orthogonal with respect to the symplectic inner product, which is defined modulo 2.
Okay.
Okay.
So in that case, what it means, let's say you have a string with an even number of ones.
Then
orthogonal
it's
orthogonal to itself?
Yes, in that definition. I mean, but again, this is symplectic inner product, so you have these two parts of it.
Yeah.
Right, so you can have strings that have an even number of ones altogether in the two halves, but are not self-dual on this symplectic inner product, I think. Wait. No, I take it. Well, okay. So actually, I mean, under the symplectic inner product, everything is dual to itself, right? Because you have whether it has even or odd. Because you have AB, and so you have A dot B plus B dot A, which is 0 mod 2. So that's true whether or not it's even weight. But yes, basically, if you're just taking, if A and B were the same, then that would be 0 mod 2 anyway.
So, and when you're claiming, let's say for the CSS code, that.
Right.
So it's made from two parity check matrix, that the two.
Ah, that's right. In that case, when I'm taking orthogonality, it is just regular inner product, and that is mod 2.
Mod 2, all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. So in fact, codes that have even codes that have all even weight things are a good place to start to look for self-dual codes,
mm-hmm.
or weakly self-dual codes. Okay, great question. Other questions? Okay, so let's kind of continue on from this last point about overall phases. So in fact, it turns out that remember I said, well, we can think of the Clifford group as defining these transformations on the xi's and zi's. And it turns out that up to overall phase, that's actually all that there is. Okay, let's put it over here. So if you have U in the Clifford group, U is uniquely defined up to global phase finds action on the polygroup. And in particular, it's action on a generating subset of the polygroup by the argument over there on the far right board. And the usual generating setup consider, of course, is the xi's and the zi's. So x on each individual qubit and z on each individual qubit. Okay. So how do you see this? Well, so let's think of u rho u dagger for some density matrix rho. Okay, so this is, we've lost the overall phase, right? So this is if you take u on a pure state psi, it'll do u rho u dagger on the corresponding mixed state. But the overall e to the I theta out front will get canceled again by the u and u dagger. So so this defines the action of u up to overall phase. So we've defined the action of u on the Pauli matrices. And the Pauli matrices, remember, they span the set of all possible n-qubit matrices. And rho is an n-qubit matrix. So we can write rho as sum over alpha c alpha p alpha. OK? Well, OK, let's do it this way. Sum over p in the Pauli group of c sub p p. Okay? And so then u rho u dagger, that's equal to u the sum over p cp p u dagger, which just by linearity is the sum over p of cp times u p u dagger. Okay? So by defining the action of p under conjugation, we've defined the action of u on some arbitrary density matrix rho. And therefore, uniquely defined u up to overall phase. So I can say that while I said this was for u in the Clipper group, which is the ones we're interested in now, it's of course true for any u. That if you define the action of u by conjugation on the Pauli group, you've defined it up to global phase on everything. Okay, so the upshot of this is that we're not really going to need to think about U as a big density matrix. It's enough to think about it as a transformation on Pauli matrices. And you see that's a big advantage because, well, the matrix, if you write it as an element of U 2 to the n, is a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. That's a big thing when n is large. But we only need to think of its action not just on the polygon, but on the generators of the polygon, right? And there's only 2 times n of those, which is a much smaller thing to think about. So there you see one of the big advantages of specializing to the polygon. OK? Question?
Yeah, I just don't see how you conclude that it defines u. I just don't see.
Oh, so do you agree that it's enough to look at the action of u on density matrices, rho?
Sure.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to write rho as, we're going to expand it as a sum of Pauli operators. Okay? So do you agree we can do that?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. So so therefore, u rho u dagger is equal to u times, well, it's equal to this sum.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so if we define u p u dagger for all p, then we know what this is. Okay? And so that tells us the action of u. Other questions? Okay. So so this is one reason why it's nice to get rid of these overall phases, because then we really can think of just the actions on the Pauli group. And the other reason, of course, is the overall phases are not going to really have any physical significance. So it's a sensible thing to do. So, but the reason not to get rid of overall phases is, as I said, because I'd like to say that the poly group is a subset, in fact, a subgroup of the Clifford group. And certainly we agree that the polys are in the Clifford group. But then there's this issue of phase. So that's what we have to do. So what we have is that Pn is a subgroup of Cn. But actually, it's more than that. Pn is a normal subgroup. And I get to talk about normal subgroups in these notes on group theory. But the upshot of this is that normal subgroups are very special kinds of subgroups. And in particular, in this case, we know that the polys, what they do is they change the phases, right? In particular, they change the phases of things that anti-commute with them, right? So if we were to conjugate by x, well, x will go to x, and z will go to minus z. So if we were to say, well, OK, let's take this control not gate, and we want to change its phases somehow. So we want x tensor I to go to minus x tensor x, but all the others still be plus. Well, all we have to do is find some poly that will, well, it depends on whether we do it before or after the C naught. But some poly that will commute with the appropriate subset of these things and anti-commute with the other thing. So for instance, if we conjugate by z tensor I, then x tensor I goes to minus x tensor I, and the others all stay plus. Right? So if we do that and then do the C naught, we get the transformation that we wanted. And so the polys control the phases. And kind of the rest of the Clifford group changes poly operators to different poly operators. I mean, some of them might stay the same. Like in the C naught, Z tensor I stays the same. But a lot of them will change. Or some of them anyway will change. Okay? So so we can rigorously define what we mean by the rest of the Clifford group by modding out the polys.
And here when you see control phases, you mean just like plus minus 1, plus minus I, right?
Well, so they don't even do plus or minus I, because all they can do is give a plus 1 if they commute with something and a minus 1 if they anti-commute. Yeah. So it's really just plus or minus 1. But they can do it separately for each of the different generators of the poly group. So they can control them independently, so it's not a global phase. So Cn mod Pn is kind of the things that if you throw away this action of phases, what you have left. So what it does to the poly group elements ignoring phases. And sometimes, of course, we want to, so there's, again, this issue of overall phase. So at this point, it's really more interesting to think of modding out not Pn, but this thing, e to the I theta, Pn, because now we really have no more use for the overall phases. Now that we've gotten rid of the polar group, which I said I wanted the phases for that, then the remaining phases we can get rid of altogether. Okay? And in fact, there's a theorem which says that this thing is equal to another group, called the symplectic group. So what is that? Well, this goes back to the binary vector representation of the polys. And SP2xz, z2, is a symplectic group over z2. You can define it over other finite fields also, or infinite fields for that matter. And it's the set of linear operations on 2n bit vectors that preserve that symplectic inner product. Which you remember was the thing that took A, B, dot C, D, and gave us A dot D plus B dot C. Okay? And those of you who have a physics background will probably have, well, might have seen symplectic groups before if you study advanced classical mechanics. And that's, you usually see a symplectic group over a real field. And it gives you a relationship between position and momentum. So this is kind of the same thing, but we're doing it with binary vectors. OK? Yes? Yes. OK, so it's maybe The first step in proving this equality is kind of obvious, because I alluded to it already, which is that you do this translation again from poly operators to binary vectors. Right? So okay. Well, I will be able to use it again. Okay. So we equate the transformations on the polys with 2n-bit linear transformations. I guess when I say this is equal, I mean isomorphic. OK, so how do you do this? Well, OK, so let's prove, which one do I want to do first? One of them is easy. Yeah. So OK, so let's prove this way first. Well, so this is pretty clear, because what we're going to do is we're going to take some element of this and show that it's in this. So to do that, all we have to do is show that it preserves the symplectic inner product. And I actually kind of did that already. So let's try that. Well, it'll be the same argument. So suppose we have some u. So preserving symplectic inner product is just saying preserving commutation, anti-commutation, right? And it does, because if we have so if we have u acting on m and n, well then the product of those two is well the u dagger u cancels, so we get u m n u dagger, which remember is equal to minus one to the m dot n. This is symplectic inner product again. U and m u dagger is minus 1 to the m dot n u n u dagger u m u dagger. So these two things commute if and only if m and n commute. Right? I showed this to you before, in fact. Okay, and so that proves this first part. Okay, so let's go the other way. Well, okay, so we kind of have the basic tools in place. We can say, well, okay, we'll have a linear transformation. That's going to determine something that happens to the x's and the z's, right? By just translating. So so given linear transformation, so we have some t that acts on v. And so we'd like you to find a u. Well, how do we do that? Well, there's kind of the obvious way of defining u, which is just to do this translation the other way. So V corresponds to some poly P. In particular, we should think of it for the P is equal to the XIs and the ZIs. And U P U dagger is then going to be the thing that corresponds to T of V sub P, right? I guess I'm using somewhat different notation here than I used before, but I hope everyone understands. Yes? But there's some ambiguity here, right? Because this is supposed to be in Cn, not Cn mod e to the I 5 Pn. So there's some phase we can do here. And we just pick one. And we do that for each xi and zi. And then we can extend u to all of the to all p in pn. Okay? And we do that by the usual thing, by taking the products of these generated set, xi's and zi's, to get the arbitrary p. And that will determine the phase for the arbitrary P. And that ensures that these phases are all consistent. And it should be clear that if you go backwards, if you do this transformation backwards, well, again, because using the same kind of argument, the U acting on the product of M and N is the product of U acting on M with U acting on N. And this product then converts to addition when we go back to the 2n vectors, 2n binary vectors, that since these vectors are kind of a spanning set of vectors in the linear space, then taking the products here to get p is the same as taking the sums on the other side to get the arbitrary vector. And because we have a... So U is a group homomorphism. Is kind of the same as saying that T is a linear transformation. Kind of the same in the sense that when we do this transformation between the two, we get from one to the other. And so this ensures that the extension works. And it's consistent with the original T. Okay? So now we have some u, so that when we do this transformation, u in the Clifford group, so that when we mod out by phases, and then do this, then convert over back over binary vectors, we get back to t. Okay, so in that sense, u is equivalent to t. And in fact, U is actually, it didn't matter which element. Suppose we have U and U prime which differ only by some element of this thing that we're modding out. Well, then U and U prime will differ only, well, so this first of all, this global phase is not gonna matter. Right? That'll disappear when we look at the transformations on the polygroup. And the only way they'll differ is they'll differ by some element of the polygroup, which will change the signs, but not the general transformation. So they will give us the same T. Right? Yeah.
I have a different question. So the polys form a basis for null matrices, and therefore you define U as a linear transformation on
right.
vectors.
Right. So the point is that basis. So the oh yeah okay sorry right. doing it to
and that so that's how you define U as a linear transformation or a matrix.
Right.
Now, the thing that's missing, at least as it appears to me, is that we haven't shown that U is unitary.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So that's the next step.
Oh, okay.
But are there other questions on this? Yeah.
So then in the earlier thing, you've shown that Cn is a subset of Sp or Cn mod Pn?
So up here.
Yeah.
Well, so the point is that if we take any element of Cn and we throw away the phases, right, then what we get is a transformation of kind of this form, but ignoring phases, right? If we throw away e to the I theta and the Pn. And that we can immediately write down as a linear transformation. And in fact, it's a symplectic transformation. So that's the logic. And so you have, I mean, if you draw it, let me stick it in here. So we have, okay, so here we have the symplectic group. And here we have Cn mod something, which you probably can't see. and sitting over that, we have Cn, right? And so this is, What we're doing is we're taking the arbitrary of the group, we're mapping it down to here, and then we have this way of translating between them. And I'm trying to show that these are actually equivalent, but meanwhile we have kind of the general, these things are subsets of things that have this general form of taking polys to polys or taking binary vectors to binary vectors. Whereas this one takes signed polys to signed polys. So we have to get rid of that before we make this direct transformation, because these vectors don't have any signs.
Yeah, but below you're showing it for any U. I mean, you're showing it U preserves?
Yeah, so the point is that, so I could say maybe that, maybe it would be better to say that U modulo, this coset U, preserves a symplectic inner product if and only if the original U preserves commutation, anti-commutation.
So you're identifying the cosets of Cn also as U's?
Well, no. I mean, so the cosets of these things are classes of U's that differ only by, you know, phases. But the phases are not going to come into this relation, right? Phases don't change whether X and Z commute, right? Minus X also anti-commutes with minus Z or plus Z. Okay, so that's why they're not so important for this question. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so now we have to answer Ackerman's question. Why is this unitary? And so to prove that, I'm actually going to prove something much bigger, which is actually his other question from before the break. How do we know that this Clipper group is generated by R, H, and C naught. Okay, so now we can erase that scratch. So in particular, what I'm going to show is that the symplectic group is generated by those things. And okay, so when I say this, I mean, first of all, not just some particular R, H, and C naught, but R, H, and C naught acting on arbitrary qubits. In the case of C naught on pairs of qubits. And the other thing is that well, there's some problem of types, right? These are unitaries, whereas those are symplectic operations. But of course, I mean, well, if you take R, H, and C naught and convert them into symplectic operations, then then you get the generators of this symplectic group. Okay. And the reason this is going to answer Ackland's question is because, well, okay, that means that we can write arbitrary elements of the symplectic group as a product of these of the things that the linear transformations that correspond to these things. Okay? And these things are in the unitary group when we raise them back up. So the linear transformation we get that's taking the product of them will also be in the unitary group when we raise it back up. Okay? So okay. So how do we prove this? Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take U in this symplectic group, and write it as, it should be a 2n by 2n matrix, right? That's what a symplectic thing is. And so we're going to think of it like this. Okay? And what this means is that when it's acting on a vector acting on xi, well, that's the vector 1 in the ith position and 0 is here. And it'll take that, well, to something of the form AICI, where these are the columns, the ith column of A and C. So that's because, assuming I did it right. Yeah, that's right. So like the first row here gets multiplied by this column vector, right, with one in the ith place. And so it's only the ith column of A that gets picked out. And similarly, as you go down. Okay? And similarly, Zi is going to get mapped to Bi, Di. Okay? And since it's symplectic, we should have these relations. We should have that first of all, the xi's commute with each other. So aici dot aj cj is always going to be equal to 0. And Similarly, the z's commute with each other. So bi di dotted with bj dj is equal to 0. And so then the last one, the interesting one, is when we consider an x and a z. So we have ai ci versus bj dj. So if these are acting on different qubits, xi and zj, then it's 0 because they should commute. Whereas if they're acting on the same qubit, they should anti-commute. So this should be delta ij. Okay. And so now what we'd like to do is, well, we already know that hr and c0 are in this group. So let's write them in this form. What happens when we do that? Well, h is switching x and z. So it turns out that h is, well, if you look at it on just a single qubit, it's of this form. Okay? And r, well, r is more interesting. R is leaving z alone, and it's taking x to y. So on a single qubit, that turns out to be this. And then c0, well, now we have to do a 2x2 thing. And it turns out that c0, well, since it takes its x to some product of x's and z to some product of z's, the off-diagonal part is going to be 0, these off-diagonal blocks. And then it takes x forward, which turns out to be this. So it's with a 1 in the lower left. And the z is the opposite one, with the 1 in the upper right. And of course, 1's along the diagonal. Okay? And so if you work this out, this is what you'll find. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to try taking an arbitrary thing of that form, A, B, C, D, and multiplying and left multiply by things of the desired form, HR and C0. And try to convert the matrix of U to the identity. Okay? And then when we've done that, what we found is we found a product of things that we can multiply by U to get the identity transformation. So we take the inverse product. Gives us how to create U, right, out of these basic things. Everyone understand that step at least? Okay. And everyone understand the basic strategy, what with the terminology, everything like that? Yes? Okay. So how do we do this? Well, the details are maybe not so important, but the basic idea is row reduction. Or Gaussian reduction. So in particular, we'll find that if you multiply by C0, what that does to A is it adds, so this is the C0, C0 between the ith qubit to the jth qubit. So it's controlled by the ith qubit. What this does is this adds the ith row of A to the jth row. Okay? Which you can kind of see by looking at this matrix, right? That's what this matrix is doing. Okay, so what we can do is we can And we also have permutations of qubits, right, which we can do by doing a bunch of C-naughts. So what we can do is, using C-naughts and this process of row reduction, we convert A to this form. OK, why do we do that? Well, if we have, suppose we have, let's pick some row of A that has the first qubit being non-trivial, okay, so it's a 1. So we can then do some permutations to move that up to the top, permutations of qubits, move that up to the top. And then what we do is we add it to all the other rows that have a 1 in the first place. And that makes them zeros in the first place, anyway. Okay, so the first column is now the way we want. And now the second column, well, we move into the second row, again, permuting qubits, some remaining row that has a 1 in second place. Okay? And then we add it. Well, first of all, if the first row has a 1 in second place, we can add the second row. And that's okay. It doesn't. The second row now has 0 in the first place. It doesn't destroy the 1 in the upper left. And we can get rid of any 1 in the first row that way. And also 1s below by adding that. And we keep doing that until we're kind of out of things. And then we'll have something of this form. Okay? So this is a standard type of thing you do in linear algebra. And of course, the size of this I would be the rank of the matrix A. OK. So the next thing we're going to do is, well, what does R do? Well, R adds so what I've written down won't work. So we're going to have to invoke something a little more complicated, and then we're going to have to kind of wing it. But we don't actually want to do this yet. So it turns out that this, if we have something of this form, this is going to be a problem for us. So I think it's probably better that I don't go through with this, since I'll be flailing around, since the original thing I wrote down is not quite right. But there's some similar procedure you can do. So C0 does row reduction on A, and R adds the ith row in general, in fact, to the ith So what does R do? Well, it takes x to xz. So it's has this form, and it's doing kind of the same thing as C naught, but between the top half and the bottom half is matrix. So it's as the ith row of A to the ith row of C. So what I was going to do is I was going to use that to get rid of most of C. But as you can see, you can't do that. It only gets rid of diagonal. And that was the problem of my argument. But so you have this kind of row reduction, you have this kind of row reduction, and then the Hadamard, well, what does it do? It switches the x and the z. So the left multiplication by Hadamard switches AB with CD. Okay. And putting these together, you can, if you work out a little bit, you can find some sequence of operations which will do what I wanted to do. It'll convert U into R. Sorry for not having a correct argument for you. But it's kind of tedious anyway. And this is relatively automatic. I mean, you don't really need to whole lot. You need to know a whole lot about this. It's just kind of a general formula you can apply. That will then break you up into a series of R, H, and C0. Yeah.
So, I don't know what do you convert it to the form that you wrote?
Oh, sorry. How do we do this?
Why do you do that?
Well, yeah, okay. So the point is that eventually I want to convert U to the identity altogether, right? So I would like to convert A into something that's just the identity. So this is kind of a move towards that. So actually, probably I think the right thing to do is to do some R's and H's, if necessary, to convert A into maximum rank. And then A actually will be the identity. But that's not enough, unfortunately. I need to also make B and C zero. And then D, it turns out, is the identity automatically because of the symplectic property. But I hadn't prepared properly to do that. So. Okay, but you understand the motivation then?
If,
okay. There were other questions, yeah.
So Daniel, they're not quite like left multiplication by these are not quite like doing the row operations? Because if they're like row operations, then we can...
Well, they are row operations, except it's more complicated because we have these four parts, A, B, C, and D. So if we only had one of those, then it would be pretty straightforward. But because we have the four of them, it's more complicated. And C naught is not a row operation on the whole thing. Because what it does, so it turns out C naught, I guess, is a row operation on A and B, but on C and D, it's kind of the inverse row operation. So it adds the ith row in the top half to the ith row, and the bottom half it adds the ith row to the jth row in the top half. In the bottom half, that's the jth row to the ith row. So that's what complicates it.
And also, I mean, in general, in row operations, you need to also sometimes multiply like a scalar multiple of one row and add to the other row, right?
Here, yeah, but in this case, these are binary matrices. So scalar multiple is 1 or 0.
Well, we're thinking U also as a binary matrix.
Yeah, so it's this SP2N over Z2. So it's a binary symplectic matrix. Other questions? Yeah.
No, so is there a transformation after which we are thinking U as having binary entries or U actually has that?
I defined U as being an SP2NZ2, so it actually has binary entries. Obviously, if we start with U as a unitary, and then we convert it over, then you have to do that conversion. But SP2NZ2 is defined to have binary entries. That's why the Z2.
No, so I thought that SP2NZ2 was the set of transformations that 2n bit vectors.
Yeah.
And preserved.
Yeah, but over bit a binary vector space, the natural thing to consider is a binary matrix, and that's what we're doing. Because otherwise, you'll take binary vectors and you'll get something else. I mean, you'll get things with much larger coefficients, right?
So
yeah. Well, there is. The problem is I didn't want to do it in class because there's no guarantee that I will get there before the end of the class. But there is a simple algorithm you can do. If you do the right sequence of things, there's a simple algorithm that will get you to the identity. And this, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not obviously properly prepared to prove that to you. But that's the statement of the theorem, right? The statement of the theorem is that you do eventually get to the identity if you do this correctly. Okay, do you have another question, Rahul? Okay.
So maybe since you're switching A and B and C and D, they look more like column operations than
Sometimes.
You're doing combination of column operations.
Yeah, I mean it's I think actually all of these were row operations.
No, wait, we're switching A slash B. Oh, A slash B. Oh, the whole of block was.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do it, if you multiply on the right, then you'll get column operations. Yes. So yeah, you could do that too, right? Which would maybe make it easier to make a cycle. Yes. Okay. So I want to move on to another topic, which I think I can get right. I may run out of space to do it, but okay. So I pointed out already that one advantage of looking at this Clifford group is you only have to think about its operation on these generators of the Pauli group, right? The Xi's and the Zi's. And so this is both a big advantage and a big disadvantage. And it turns out that if you have a sequence of Clifford group operations, well, what do you do? You map the Xi's to something and the Zi's to something, and then you do it again. And it turns out that following the evolution here is something that you can do very efficiently. Well, you can do efficiently in the sense of polynomial on a classical computer. And actually, it's not that bad. It takes time to order n squared using the best algorithm. So what that means is that the Clifford group is something that you can simulate efficiently classically, which on the one hand means that it's not useful for doing interesting quantum computations in the sense of, you know, factoring algorithm or something that you couldn't do classically. But on the other, well, we know that using this Clifford group, we can generate an arbitrary stabilizer, right? An arbitrary stabilizer code. So I could say that one application of this theorem is to find an encoding circuit for stabilizer code, right? You write down the operation that maps the initial state with z's for your ancilla qubits to this final stabilizer that you want, and then you're done. Okay, and you figure out how to do that in terms of these things. So quantum error correcting code, that's an interesting application. So it's nice that we can simulate that classically. So anyway, so that's this next theorem that I want to show. And what happened to that here? So given a circuit with a stabilizer initial state, and the circuit consists only of Clifford group operations. Which, so it might be that which Clifford group we do depends on some classical data. And we also allow, well, in order to have a sensible circuit, we could have measurements so that we get some answer. And we're going to allow measurements of poly operators. Then there exists an efficient classical simulation, just what I said before.
So when you say controlled classically, do you mean sort of there's an ansa, you measure it, then you control your gain after that, or can you just completely?
Yeah, no. So okay, so it could be that there's some complicated classical information on the side that's going through some computation. Mostly, it's what you said, that there's some ansa. You measure it, and that determines what gate you do.
Okay, so in that case, would it imply that if you have, let's say, a one-qubit gate in your in the Clifford group, like a Hadamard, then the controlled Hadamard is also in the Clifford group?
Well, only if it's classically controlled. Controlled Hadamard is actually not in the Clifford group.
But well, classically controlled is the same thing as sort of quantumly controlled it, then measure at the end, right?
Well, yes, kind of. But the problem is that with the controlled Hadamard, you can do more things. So I guess maybe the way to say this is that if you have a controlled Hadamard, and then instead of measuring the first qubit, you do, say, another Hadamard on it or something like that,
okay,
then you get the possibility of doing all sorts of other stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a good question. So in some sense, this is involving things outside the Clifford group because they're classically controlled. But it's, you're very constrained in how that works.
Then what do you mean by measurements of poly?
I mean, so, okay, so poly operator has eigenvalues plus or minus one. And so I want to project on the two subspaces, the plus one eigenspace and the minus one eigenspace, and see which eigenspace I'm in. If you like, you can just say measurement of single qubits in a standard basis, because that's going to be equivalent to this, because you can do an arbitrary poly measurement you can do by doing some Clifford group to convert that poly into Zi, and then measuring Zi.
Well, so basically you mean that you're allowed to measure in the eigenbasis of P, any Pn.
Yeah, but of course the Pns have very degenerate eigenbasis, so it's just half the whole space, the whole Hilbert space, the big Hilbert space. Okay, so we don't want to have to necessarily make a complete measurement. This could be a partial measurement. In the sense that we're not measuring all the qubits. Great. And in fact, it's we'll consider a slightly more general case where the initial state is not just a stabilizer state, but some of the initial qubits might be unconstrained. Okay. And our strategy in this proof will be to follow the evolution of logical X and Z operators. Okay. And of course, if we do a Clifford group, right, we conjugate just as before. Whereas if we do measurements, that's going to be the main new content here. Okay, so to do this, I'm going to do an example while I introduce the necessary components. And that example is going to be to see what happens in a teleportation circuit. Which contains all of these components, right? So teleportation, where we start out with one qubit unconstrained and two qubits that are in an EPR pair, right? And then we do a controlled knot, and we want to do a Bell measurement, right, on these first two qubits. So do that, we do a controlled knot, and then we measure this first qubit in the x basis and the second qubit in the z basis. And this gives us two classical bits, A and B. And we send those classical bits down here and do a Pauli operation depending on A and B. Right? And we're supposed to get out the original state. Right? So, okay. So let's do this in terms of stabilizers. Well, so at the start, we have a stabilizer, which is IXX and IZZ, right? Because this 0, 0 plus 1 is an plus 1 eigenstate of XX and ZZ. That's its stabilizer. And the first qubit is unconstrained. So for the first qubit, we should track logical Pauli operators, right? X bar and Z bar, which we're going to start as XII and ZII. Okay? And then the first thing we do is we do a controlled NOT gate. And the controlled NOT gate, well, remember, the whole reason we determined this was to see what happens with stabilizer. Right? And the stabilizer replaces elements of the stabilizer M with things of the form U, M, U dagger. Right? So IXX is going to be replaced by U IXX, U dagger. What does C0 do to these two things? Well, C0 takes I, so it's acting on the first two qubits. IX, if you look up there, goes to IX. So IXX will go to IXX. But IZ goes to ZZ. Right? So IZZ will go to ZZZ. XII, well, XI goes to XX. So here's X bar, here's Z bar. And ZII goes to ZII. Okay, question?
No, I think I'm fine.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So you can see that if we had a whole bunch of C0 of Clifford unitaries, we could continue to follow this evolution for a long time, right? And all we have to keep track of would be the stabilizer in these X bar and Z bar things. So in the worst case, there's 2n operations to keep track of, each of which involves 2n bits, or maybe 2n plus 1 or 2 if you have to keep track of the overall phase of each, which I guess you do. Okay? So it's clear that we could do that. We could simulate any number of Clifford group operations here. Right? Okay? There's a question? Yeah?
Why are we actually following the encoded X and Z?
So for this theorem as it's stated, we don't need to do that because we're only interested in stabilized initial state. But teleportation, well, we don't really know what the first qubit is. So What we're going to do, it'll be maybe a little more obvious at the end, but what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, if we do all of this, then what's going to happen is there's going to be some overall Clifford transformation on this qubit. In this case, it's teleportation, so it could be the identity. But we're going to be able to recognize by seeing what happens to the logical x and the logical z, they'll get converted to some function of those. Okay, again, this would be a little more obvious at the end.
But here in that case, so what do you call logical x, logical z? Do you mean it like just something which just belongs to the normalizer and the x and z or?
Yeah, so in this case, when we have a stabilizer describing two of the qubits, then these things have to be, at all times, they're going to have to be in n of s.
Yeah.
That's right. So this is like the logical x and log. So the thing is that this is in some sense a stabilizer code, this initial state. And the logical x and logical z are the logical x and logical z I defined last week. Okay. Of course, it's not a stabilizer code that's interesting for its error correction properties. It's interesting for a different reason. And because of the way it's initially set up, you can see that the logical x and logical z can just be the physical x and the physical z on the first qubit. But as we go along, like after this first CNOT operation, now it's entangled, so it's more complicated.
But like, for example, we could have also used the logical x to be xxx and logical z to be...
Initially, that's right. They would have been equivalent.
Right?
That's right. We could have done that.
Okay.
So, yeah, so this is not a unique representation. The stabilizer, for instance, has a lot of different choices of generators. But it's useful for this. All we need is to find one that's good enough. So, okay, so can I move on now to measurements? More difficult. No, it's gone. Class is almost over anyway. Okay. Let's suppose we want to measure some Pauli operator in a piece of n. Okay. So there's let's first consider the case where we have a complete stabilizer, so there are no unconstrained qubits. Well, then there's two possibilities, right? So one case is where P is actually in the stabilizer. Or I guess I could say plus or minus P is in the stabilizer. So in that case, it's kind of obvious what will happen. Since the state has a definite eigenvalue for P, when we measure P, we'll get that eigenvalue. Okay. So what's maybe not quite so obvious is that you can figure out whether it's a plus eigenvalue or minus eigenvalue in a reasonable amount of time. And I'm not going to go through the details of that, but the way you do that is you convert to so why is that not obvious? Well, it might be P is not one of the generators of the stabilizer, the way we've written it down. So we have to figure out how to write P or minus P as a product of those generators. And when we figure out what that product is, then we figure out whether it's plus or minus. Okay? So the way to do that basically is to treat it as an exercise in linear algebra. You convert P into a binary vector. You convert the generators into binary vectors, length 2n. And then you see it's a linear algebra problem. You want to write one vector as a linear combination of these other vectors. So, you know, there's ways to do that. Okay, so case two is when P, in the case where we have, commutation is going to come into it. So case two is the case where P is outside N of S. So what that means is there's something in the stabilizer that doesn't commute with it. So in the case where we have a complete stabilizer state, where there's no unconstrained qubits, well, then n of s is just equal to s. So those are the only two cases. In the case where we have unconstrained qubits, there's going to be a third case. So let's just consider this for the moment. So what happens when p is not an n of s? Well, in this case, it turns out that we're equally likely to get plus or minus either eigenvalue of p. So why is that? Well, we'd like to calculate is trace p rho, where rho is the state that we have. What we know about rho is that, so we know that there's some m in the stabilizer, such that m and p anti-commute. So if you multiply rho by projector on the plus one eigenstate of m, we're not doing anything, right? We're allowed to do that. So this we could write as trace, let's put a 1/4 out front, 1 plus m rho, and a 1 plus m on the other side too, just, well, we'll need it anyway in the end. Okay? So we're allowed to do this. Right? This doesn't change rho. Yes? Happy? Well, now we can use this fact that m and p anti-commute. Right? So this is 1/4 trace 1, well, p goes through I, but it gets a minus sign when it goes through m. So we get 1 minus m, p rho 1 plus m here. Okay? And using simplicity of the trace, we can move this 1 minus m over to the right. But now we have the projector on the plus one eigenstate of m and the minus one eigenstate. And so that gives us 0. Okay? So what this tells us is that the expectation value of p is 0. We're equally likely to get plus one and minus one as eigenvalues.
Rho is a stabilizer state, right?
So if we consider the case where there's no unconstrained qubits, then rho is a stabilizer state. Otherwise, it's a state from a stabilizer code.
Yeah.
Right. So our classical simulation can just flip a coin and choose one equally. Flip a fair coin and choose plus one or minus one, depending on the result of the coin. Okay? But that's not enough. We need to know, since this is only one qubit that we're measuring, or one poly operator, there's still a lot of stuff left here. So we need to know what happens to the stabilizer and to the X bar and Z bar operator. Well, okay, so plus or minus P, so this new state is an eigenstate. We projected on an eigenstate of P, right? Either plus one or minus one. So plus or minus P is added to the stabilizer. But M is going to get kicked out because, well, M and P anti-commute, so they can't both be part of the stabilizer. So now let's consider that we have some N in S where N and P commute. Well, then it turns out that N remains in the stabilizer. Why is that? Well, suppose we have a projector suppose we take some state psi, we project it onto the plus one or minus one eigenvalue of p, and then see what its eigenvalue is for n. Well, n commutes through, So this is the same projector acting on n psi. And of course, psi n is in the stabilizer, so n psi is equal to psi. So we've just seen that, this projected psi is still has a plus one eigenvalue for n. Okay. But what about other things in the stabilizer that don't commute with p? Well, they could get kicked out like m. But what if there's lots of them, right? Then the stabilizer might be too small. But remember, this choice of generator is arbitrary. And so, in fact, it turns out that always, if you have any Pauli operator, then exactly half the stabilizers are going to commute with it, and half the stabilizers are going to anti-commute with it. And the reason you can see that is if n anti-commutes with p, then we have this particular special element that anti-commutes that we've already kicked out. And mn will commute with p. Right? Because if we have two things that anti-commute with p, then each time we move one of them past p, we get a minus sign. So it's two minus signs is a plus. Okay? So therefore, replace so if we take the other generators, so if so we place them as follows. And if ni commutes with p, we keep it. And if it anti-commutes, then we replace it with m times ni. Okay? And we do the same thing for the x bars and the z bars. Okay. So what does that do over here in our example? Well, so up here we do a measurement of x. So let's do that. So x on the first qubit commutes with IXX. So IXX stays in the stabilizer. But ZZZ doesn't commute. So we have to throw it out and replace it with XII. But we'll have a sign, which I'll call, I guess, minus 1 to the A. Okay? So this is a new stabilizer. In this case, there was only the one thing that anti-commuted, so we only had to kick it out and replace it. But what about the X bar and Z bar? Well, X bar, XXI, that commutes. So we're okay. And Z bar doesn't. Z bar anti-commutes with this thing. So if we were to leave it in, then it wouldn't be an N of X. So that's not allowed. So what do we do? Well, we have to multiply. Remember, Z bar could have been a different thing. It could have been Z bar times ZZZ. And that's what the rule says. We should multiply Z bar by this M that we kicked out. So Z bar gets replaced with IZZ, which commutes. OK? So now let me point something else out, which is that we'd really like to ignore this first qubit from that one. But unfortunately, X bar still acts on the first qubit. So now it's helpful to rewrite X bar by multiplying, again, by an element of the stabilizer. So in that case, we multiply by this to get rid of this first x, which gives us a phase minus 1 to the a, but then we have IXI. OK? And from now on, we can ignore the first qubit. So next thing we do is we measure z. This is x1, this is z2. So z2 anti-commutes with this. So we have to kick this out. And so the stabilizer is now I, Z, I, and there's a phase minus 1 to the B. And then we have the X, I, I, phase minus 1 to the A. X bar is equal to minus 1 to the A, I, X, I. And Z bar, well, what is that equal to? That's not right. Sorry, Z bar is an easy one. Z bar commutes with I, Z, I. So we can keep that as I, Z, Z. But X bar doesn't commute, right? I, X, I, anti-commutes with I, Z, I. So we have to kick it out and multiply by this. But what do we do when that happens? Well, I, X, I becomes I, I, X. And we still have this minus 1 to the A up front. No, that's not right. It becomes I, I, X. I, I, X, which commutes with I, Z, I. Okay? But again, we've measured the second qubit. We'd like to get rid of it. So how do we do that? Well, we rewrite Z by multiplying by this. So I, Z, Z becomes minus 1 to the B, I, I, Z. Okay? And now maybe you can see what I was talking about at the beginning. The X bar and the Z bar have been converted to an X and a Z on the third qubit, which is how we can identify that the encoded qubit, the logical qubit, has moved from the first physical qubit to the third physical qubit. But in doing so, it's gotten these phases, minus 1 to the A, minus 1 to the B. And so the Pauli operation gets rid of that, right? Remember, that's what Pauli operations do. We choose one that anti-commutes appropriately to change the phases. Okay? Don't know if I want to write it down. But it didn't come up in this particular example, but there was that case 3, right? What happens if we have unconstrained qubits and P is not in S, but it's in N of S, right? So it's in N of S minus S. What do you think happens there? Say louder.
We can't detect that.
We can't detect it. Well, that's certainly true. I mean, it's something that's commuting with the stabilizer. So, but we're not in this case, we're not treating the stabilizer really as a quantum error correcting code. So we're not measuring the eigenvalue of the stabilizer specifically. But it's true that this thing is telling us something other than what's in the stabilizer. So there's some additional information here somehow. Any other suggestions? Remember what else is in N of S. Right? Those are the X bar and the Z bar operations. And in fact, the X bar and the Z bar generate N of S, well, along with S. Right? They generate N of S mod S. Okay? So what happens when we measure something in N of S that's not in S is we're finding out about the encoded state. We're learning some information about it. Okay? Does everyone see that? Okay. So for instance, if we were to measure, in this case, if we were to measure somewhere halfway in between, we'd measure X bar. Well, that would be the same as measuring this initial qubit in the X basis. We get exactly the same result. So if we started with an X eigenstate, we'd get that eigenvalue. Okay? So that's it for today. Like I said, next week, guest lectures. The week after that, I'm back, and we'll talk about bounds on quantum error correcting codes, upper and lower bounds.